The Mina Kimes Show featuring Lenny is presented for the people by Caesars Sportsbook. You bet, you get with Caesars Rewards. Must be 21 or older.
Welcome back to the Mina Kimes Show featuring Lenny, only NFL podcast where one of the hosts thinks pulling action is what Huskies do. That's Lenny. We had to make an offensive line-centric joke at the start of this podcast because in place of Dominique Foxworth, who is taking this Tuesday off, I am delighted to be joined by my friend, first-time guest, friend of many friends of the show, 11-year NFL vet, Super Bowl champion. There's a million things I could say about him, but I'll just bring him in. Marshall Newhouse, thank you so much for joining us to recap a very exciting super wild card weekend.
Yeah, you got to add the super. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me here. My dog is currently taking a nap, but I always pay homage to the person who really runs things, Lenny. And I would like to pay my, you know, respects and know that there's another pup here who also pays his respects. So I know where the bread is buttered. But yeah, thanks for having me.
You guys can check out Marshall on Twitter or X or whatever you want. X is like the super wild card of names. I'm just refuse to acknowledge it. It's M Newhouse 73, right?
73, yeah.
73. I will send that out. Before we get started, a little bit of housekeeping. We're going to do winners and losers, woofs, pardon me, from every single game. I am going to be in Las Vegas for the Super Bowl, as I usually do, to do NFL Live and such. And Dominique Foxworth and I are doing a live show. Actually, Bill Barnwell is going to be there. Kevin Clark is going to be there. It is going to be extremely fun. It is the Thursday of the week before the Super Bowl, which I believe is February 8th. Make sure I have that right, actually. And I haven't sent out a link yet, so I'm telling you about it. If you're a listener and you live in the area, you can find tickets now. I haven't publicized it yet at bit.ly/MinaFox. And it's going to be at 5 p.m. It is Thursday, February 8th at Jimmy Kimmel's Comedy Club. So that's really exciting. I'm excited to be there. That's going to be a lot of fun. And there's a rumor that there might be hats. Marshall, I did a live show in Seattle with Danny Kelly and KJ Wright a long time ago, and we made hats, and they're very hot ticket, limited edition item. So they might be back for the show.
People always poo-pooed, you know, when you won the division. You know, it's hats and t-shirts game. I love getting a hat and t-shirt. I tell you what, I knew that wasn't the end of the row, but I'm like, give me my hat and t-shirt. I'm putting that in the closet. I'm giving that to my nephew. Give it to me.
I actually wasn't familiar with all of the teams that you played for. It is so many. I don't remember which team you were on. Okay. So I thought of you this weekend and in one of the games, we're going to probably do this one. We're going to go reverse chronological order.
All right.
But, I don't know if anyone hit you up when, I don't know how to describe this. Desmond King sort of tackled Joe Flacco and spun around.
Oh, I know where you're going with this. Oh my God.
Kind of like breakdancing style. So what should people Google to see the video of? Can you describe for people?
Listen, I am not going to point people in the direction of one of the most infamous plays of my career, because you can find it if you just Google my name. But I am familiar with the centrifugal forces that football can create on the field when guys are flying around. So I'll leave it at that.
You had the ball, which is rare because you're an offensive lineman.
Yes, yes.
And it was sort of like a helicopter motion before the ball came out, if I remember correctly. We did not know each other at the time.
I'm already panicking because I think I gave up a pressure strip sack. So I'm following the ball. It takes a fortuitous bounce high enough for me to scoop it. And I'm like, all right, let me get to the line of scrimmage. All right, I think I'm there. And things are moving just fast. Got linemen don't carry the ball often. And I'm like, all right, let me just trudge forward. I'll at least fall down forward. I have the ball. We live to fight another day. Out of the corner of my eye, because, you know, I've got running back in my blood. My dad played running back in college. My cousin Robert Newhouse played full back for the Cowboys in the NFL. It just takes over. Out of the corner of my eye, I see Kiko Alonso coming for my knee. I'm like, how do I avoid shattering my leg? And so I lift my leg up a little bit, but then physics takes over, and I spin – I fumble the ball. I land terribly, awkwardly. I like bruise. I had a huge contusion on my hip and on the spot where Kiko speared me. I fumble the ball, and it ends up being just a horrible moment that I am laughing off still to this day. But it's like the Arthur Fist where I'm like, people mention it. Yeah, I'm laughing, but I'm also like, fight me. So
it was a very memeable moment. I think just because you don't usually see people your size moving that way.
You saw a tidbit of my athleticism, and I will always lean on that. When I eventually have kids, they're only going to see the first part of me moving as fast as I could, and then I'm cutting the video. So that's all
right. Well, as embarrassing as it is, it's not as embarrassing as what's happening with the Philadelphia Eagles organization. Let's start there. So like I said, we're going to work backwards. We're going to start with the Eagles Bucks and then work all the way back to the Browns and the aforementioned breakdancing tackle on top of Joe Flacco. So we're rotating who gets to do the winner, who gets to do the woof. I gave you the winner for this game. I think we should start with the woof, though, and there's no disrespect to the Bucks because there's a lot to say about them, and I think obviously that season's been really exciting. But this feels like such a pivotal moment for the Eagles franchise, and it's a moment that's obviously the culmination of now several weeks losing six of their last seven games and whatnot, and it got to the point where Dominique and I would almost get tired of like putting the Eagles in our losers or woofs column on Tuesdays. We were just like, it's the same stuff. But I think what struck me, Marshall, and in this respect, I think you have the Cowboys in that game. Well, assuming you're going to have someone from there as a loser. I'll start here. This felt worse to me than the Cowboys loss. Maybe not worse than that, like the Cowboys loss is worse because that team probably should have gotten farther and whatnot. But worse for me in that, like the Cowboys got, I thought, outcoached, and we'll talk about that, and the quarterback had a bad game. The Eagles, watching them, not only were they outcoached and unprepared on both sides of the ball, it also felt like they were just out efforted. And it's like, I mean, this is a team that really limped to the finish line. And I think just to see something, there was some part of me that was like, they gotta go into this game with a better plan for the blitz, and Jalen Hurts has to, you know, be more poised under pressure and maybe carry the football more, and the defense can't miss as many tackles. Like, none of those things, it can't be as bad as it's been. And it was actually worse than I expected in all of the ways. It was like so predictable. And that, I think, takes us to now. We're taping this on Tuesday, January 16th. I don't know what's going to hit your ears. There are legitimate questions about the future of Nick Sirianni in Philadelphia, and I don't think they're crazy. Like, I really don't. Like, after not just a loss like this, but a string, we're definitely going to move on for both their coordinators, I think. But at a certain point, like, he really deserves responsibility for everything that's gone wrong.
It's truly just a wild chain of events that they had built up so much benefit of the doubt after their Super Bowl run and them building this thing up. Because, you know, Jalen Hurts was an unproven just over a year ago. And so he goes from unproven to a QB that you could take, that can take you to the Super Bowl. He gets the massive contract that now you lose all the leverage of a young QB on a rookie deal. But you assume that at minimum, they're going to be a team that's well-constructed, their foundation is set. And then regardless of if they win or they go on runs or not, you know, they'll be there competing for the foreseeable future. To now, the last 6 weeks, we don't know who this team is. I don't know if this team knows who they are. I was texting a friend of mine, Jeff Schwartz, so you know, just about, I wish someone had the confidence in me that people seem to continue to have in Matt Patricia, because I'm not sure what he brings to the table, because all I see is an Eagles defense that is a poorly stringed together defense, poorly tackling, poor effort. I mean, that long run after the catch for Tampa, that was a touchdown. We saw multiple guys not wrap up, we call it a vice, where you play with the guy inside of you or outside of you, and you squeeze the ball carrier to tackle him multiple times where the angles were just awful.
And then what was Bradley Roby going on that? And then he's an NFL player. He's played for years. Like, I mean, it was crazy. I was like, I feel like, and they're not, these are veterans.
Yeah. These are stars. I mean, James Bradbury looked lost. I mean, he might be at the end of his career. I played with him in Carolina. He's a great guy. I really thought he was an underrated corner for a long time, and he's now found a new home and got his deal. But he looked lost. I mean, there are multiple tackle for losses that just slipped out of his hands that turned into explosives. And time and time again, this Eagles defense looked just out of it. They looked a little bit checked out. And you're like, all right, you give a team a pass that made the Super Bowl run last year. At towards the end of the season, they're not playing well. Okay, you can chalk that up to a lot of different things. But you hope a group of veterans like that. We always talk about the switch being flipped. Some people, that is a legitimate thing where you're like, all right, guys, let's stop screwing around collectively. You know, in practice, we're on it a little more. The intensity goes up, the urgency goes up, and you can feel it, and guys ultimately perform. And sometimes it results in a win, sometimes it doesn't. But this Eagles team didn't look like they responded to poor performance for 6 weeks in a row. And I don't know how you chalk that up to anything other than a lack of leadership or accountability. And we're not inside the locker room. We don't know exactly what it was, but it showed itself on the field. This Eagles defense, listen, Baker Mayfield in Tampa – most of the season were average and a lot. I think Baker is kind of a comeback player of the year candidate. I've loved his season. I love the fit there. I think they're going to re-sign him. I think that's a good move for them. I love Todd Bowles getting a little bit of vindication as a good coach who's – they made the playoffs. They eked in a very weak division. But they're still a team with pieces. Tristan Wirfs is now your franchise left tackle, and you can build from there. I like Tampa a lot, but there's no reason why Baker Mayfield should be throwing all over the field. Baker almost threw a couple picks. I mean, it wasn't – they didn't play flawlessly, but to still play like Tampa played at their baseline. I don't think Tampa played out of their minds. They played how they've kind of been playing and what they've been capable of. They played fine. They played fine. But the Eagles looked like they just kind of allowed things to happen, and it looked like a team of guys that were all looking to the left and the right like, oh, he'll make the play. He'll make the play. And, you know, credit to Devontae Smith. He finally was like, guys, I'm going to make the plays. I don't know what everyone else is doing. I'm going to be the guy. I'm going to get open. I'm going to make explosives. I'm going to make somebody miss. Fletcher Cox looked like guy. You know, Jalen Carter looked like guys who were trying to make a difference. But you need 22 of those. You don't need – it can't just be three guys who have it turned on.
Milton Williams had a big play. I mean, there were a couple – you know, a few flashes here and there. But – and I'm going to ask you about the Bucs in a second. I think it was maybe on the very first drive when, and I don't remember what down it was, but Bowles sent a six-man pressure, as he does, and Hurts just threw a go ball, like a prayer. And coming into this game, again, I was like, there's no way they're not going to show us something different versus the blitz from what we've been seeing all year. We know this quarterback has not been good against the blitz. We know that's been an issue over the course of his career, and it's gotten dramatically worse this season. We also know that, like, you know, he doesn't even have hot route. Like, there's like no one underneath available to him, or if they are, it's doomed to fail, or it's like a prayer downfield. It was such an insult to injury that, like, Baker ended up throwing that final touchdown versus like the blitz, because I was just like, God, like, this has just not been there for Philadelphia the entire game. And yet to see that come to fruition, like, again, in such predictable fashion, was just jarring. I could not fathom.
I expected so much more out of Brian Johnson. I mean, I thought he was ascendant. Like, he felt like I know him familiar for years because he played at Utah. I was at TCU. We played each other in college. And I was paying attention to his rise as a coach and just the way he handled himself as a young coach. I'm like, he's got a future, a bright future. And you get him in a place with a quarterback like Jalen Hurts, it feels like it. That was the type of quarterback Brian Johnson was. And it feels like, all right, there's some synergy here. There's some connectivity here. They've got everything that you want to be a dynamic offense. And then just in the simple chess checkers game that is offensive coordinators versus defensive coordinators, it felt like he just stood pat too often. It felt like he was like, all right, they're going to continue to correct and correct and correct. And eventually my MO is just going to win out. And I'm like, that's not how this works. These teams are trying to take away what you do best. Then they're going to take away the second thing. So what is your third, fourth, fifth thing to get, DeAndre Swift, the ball in space on screens.
They refused to do that the entire season.
It didn't make sense. I was like, call a slow screen. It's a very simple play. It requires timing and practice and repetition, but that is the base layer of of challenging, blitzing, a six-man rush, a pass rush, just out of the gate. And it felt like they wouldn't even do that. And it was kind of jarring to me.
Which is perplexing because your linemen are so good at moving in space.
Maybe you should be the most athletic, meant for screens and in space center in the game in this generation, who now sadly we hear is going to retire.
Oh, yes.
His last game. Sorry if I stepped on something. But you've got him as a weapon. How often do you hear of a center being described over his career as a weapon? He's a weapon. And it just didn't feel like that was ingrained into their game plan.
Well, I should have mentioned that at the top. Jason Kelce, the Eagles future Hall of Fame center, announced his retirement. You know, when I talked about this kind of being a pivotal offseason, I think, you still have a lot of talent on offense. Defensively, and I think maybe just to kind of put a pin in this here, like, what needs to be done? So I will see what happens with Sirianni, man. But, like, let me just put it this way. If he's replaced, I don't think it would be shocking, especially given the caliber of coaches who are available, right? Like, but what we're talking about to me is so, whether it was like the panicked elevation of Matt Patricia, the fact that Sirianni, who has been a play caller, never stepped in, or if he did step in, it didn't work out to change things. It all ultimately does fall at his feet. So if he's replaced, sure. But if he's not, they need to change the coaching staff. And I think the biggest, there's two tasks really for Philadelphia to, you know, try to get competitive again. Defensive wise, you got to get younger and better in the secondary. Linebacker obviously is an issue. So that's more about personnel. And you need competent coaching, clearly, and something fell apart there. But that's, I think, from this offseason, you bring in someone, you know, but personnel. Offensively, I just think this weekend to me, Marshall, and we don't even need to get into this because we're going to get into it with the other games, was such a stark showcase for offensive play callers who help their quarterbacks with scheme. The young quarterbacks, we're going to talk Houston, Green Bay, Detroit, who's not a young quarterback. When you see that, and then you watch the Eagles, where it's so static. It's just this spread. We're going to beat you. We've got our guys. You can't do that anymore, and you're not talented enough to do that when you don't have a quarterback who can run and change the numbers the way he did last year. So whatever happens to the Eagles this offseason, they need to recognize that this offense needs a dramatic overhaul to help the quarterback, because the quarterback's still gonna be your quarterback.
As unstoppable as the tush push was all year, it's amazing that seems like a band-aid that covered the inequities of this offense. For, you know, how many times they were successful, I think 17, 18 times this year on the tush push. That's 17, 18 reps that we don't even know what they would have called. We're not even sure what they would even been thinking to convert these third down and short opportunities. And you mentioned these other guys from the Shanahan McVay tree. There's a common theme, and yeah, they're all baking a little bit different of a dish, but they are catering to the strengths of their personnel from a game-to-game basis. They are protecting. If they've got a weak spot on the line, they're protecting him with play action. If they've got a rookie young quarterback, they're getting him under center early and throwing play action, giving him checkdowns, giving him opportunities, easy completions. And then what we're doing is they're flipping the old, you run to open up the pass on its head, where we're making teams defend every square inch of the field, and then we hit you with a behind, or we hit you with a crossing tight end who seals on a zone play, and you've got gashes, you've got 7-8 yard gains, you're moving the chains. I'm looking at the stat line, and we'll get to it later. CJ Stroud and Jordan Love only threw the ball each 21 times. It wasn't like they were back there throwing, dropping back 35 to 40 times a game. These were efficient games being called, and Philadelphia all year just hasn't looked efficient. And I don't know what it will take for them to, and it's not changing your entire identity on offense, but we're just talking about doing the bare minimum of just smart things to put your guys in a better position to win. And that to me just screams some arrogance. And, you know, people love Sirianni and just his confidence and the brashness when they were winning. I mean, we've seen him multiple times screaming at fans, walking off fields after they win. Are we now starting to see, I guess it's all subjective because we're not in the building, we're starting to see that is a real arrogance that is blinding you a little bit to fixing, minor tweaking the things that are going to make your team successful. So we don't know.
Because these were problems from the beginning of the season, even when they're winning games. And I think that probably papered over a lot, even though they, you know, they were winning by small margins. The point differential wasn't there, but these problems were not new. Okay. The Bucks. Give us a winner from the Bucks side of things, who are going to, of course, move on to play the Detroit Lions.
It's got to be Baker Mayfield. You see his the last 3 years of his career, just the turmoil. And, you know, the way that Cleveland fans treated him on his way out with a banged up throwing shoulder just felt so short-sighted to me, when we know this guy can do everything you want to do when he's healthy. He played through it, give him all the credit in the world. And then, you know, I had a lot of empathy for him the last couple of years, because there was a 2 year season span where I played on four different teams. And I know what that's like. And I'm not a quarterback, but I also know what that's like. He went across country. He came in the middle of the week, studied a game plan, the bare minimum of a playbook, and started in a game. I've done that before, literally in New England. It's such a dramatic shock to your central nervous system, and to do it at the QB position is a lot. So for him to take all that, channel all of those experiences, get to a place that feels like they want him. Now, it wasn't a splashy signing in Tampa. Tampa's still reeling from the vacuum that is the absence of Tom Brady in the Super Bowl, and want figuring out who they are, how Todd Bowles can lead, what they have moving forward. Now, it pays to be in a division that seems allergic to winning. That helps a lot. You know, you've got one team we'll call it two teams that seem in complete disarray, and then another team that's been kicking salary cap cans for a better part of a decade, that we're not sure what kind of shape they're in. They're kind of settling for this mid-tier performance and mid-tier value from their quarterback in New Orleans. And so it helps that your division was winnable. But I give Baker Mayfield all the credit in the world for just, you know, we talk about, you know, guys always say, oh, I'm ignoring the noise. I'm just going to do my thing. And he truly just like went down to Tampa, Florida, little old Tampa, Florida, was very quiet. They were winning games 9-0 and not in the most impressive fashion, but they win the division. You get a home playoff game. And I saw all the panelists' picks, and they still felt like Philly was going to turn the switch on. And Tampa said, no. Baker from the first drive was Baker. I mean, I remember I saw him walking out doing the smelling salts, and you could tell he was just in a different mindset for a quarterback, that he still has a lot to prove, and he's got a lot to like there. And I think I like that fit a lot for them. I think his price is going to be very affordable for them and reasonable for them to continue to build around him and build into that defense. And to me, Baker is a winner, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, for him to go down there, have the season he'd had, and then win a playoff game, regardless of what happens next, is so beyond expectations, and will probably lead to them keeping him around regardless of what happens the next round. I think that the highest compliment I could give him is watching this game. When he dropped back, I was confident in him in a way I never felt confident in Philadelphia, right? Like just Baker's been fine. I'd say he's been an above average quarterback this year. There's been inconsistencies. There's been games like against Green Bay where he was like lights out. And you know, there's been games where he's had some misses downfield. But in this game, he looks so much more decisive as a passer than Hurts. He could have had more yards if Evans hadn't, you know, had a couple drops. So, you know, I think they were a very good moment for him. I think this offense is really built around what he does well. You know, having tight ends on the field, the play action pass, throwing over the middle of the field, getting the ball out quickly. We'll preview the game next week, but I do have some optimism about them on that side of the football. And the team generally too, you know, this was mentioned a lot during the broadcast when I heard it, just how they were in cap hell and how their GM Jason Light, like how he's handled the post Tom Brady era. And it really looks like they've successfully hit on some picks. Kalijah Kancey was stupendous in this game. He's a prospect I really liked. He's been great all year once he got healthy. And then you have younger players, you know, and then the trenches on both sides of the ball. So big win for Tampa. They were clearly the better team. like you said, it's a great win for Baker. I'll get into the matchup next week. But they're fun to watch. I enjoy – the Eagles were just so excruciating to watch by the end, man. Like, it was just, like, both sides. There was no joy in watching them this year.
Well, yeah, that's a great way to put it, like, no joy. And, like, even teams that we've seen not play as well, but they're attempting to, like, stretch – the boundaries of what football is. They're trying to, you know, innovate on what they've done. And the Eagles felt compelled to just play this Madden style drop back passing offense that defensive coordinators have now said, I hope that you do this. They're playing as much cover four and cover six as they've ever played, keeping everything in front of them. And they're hoping that all you want to do is play 7-on-7. Please play 7-on-7. We'll rally the ball. We'll tackle. You'll eventually miss a receiver. You'll eventually run a route short of the sticks. Your pass protection will give up because you're not varying the looks for the defensive lineman. Our rush, there's more dynamic pass rushes than there's ever been in the league. We'll get home eventually, and over, you know, just on aggregate over the course of a game, we'll win out. If that's how you want to play, we'll win out. If you're not going to throw under center any play action, deep crossing routes, you're not going to, you know, take advantage of these pockets that are being created, dial in the flats, run at undersized linebackers. You know, we've seen this swing from giant linebackers to cover linebackers back to, you know, these cover linebackers in nickel who they're not as adept at tackling. We'll talk about Josh Allen later. There's an entire swing, and you choosing to not run at them over and over again and make them be honest throughout a game is playing right into these defensive coordinators' hands. And Philly has some soul searching to do. Absolutely.
Well, that's a good transition, because my winner from Bill Steelers is running Josh Allen, not just Josh Allen, running Josh Allen. This is something, I mentioned this a lot, but it was obviously very much so on display in this game where he had the 52-yard touchdown run. Him with his legs in January is just the great equalizer. And it is something that as the season goes on, they lean on more and more. And in the playoffs, whether it was, you know, Dorsey, Dable, or now Joe Brady, it's just a button that is always available for them to push. He is, and I think it's like, because we're in a moment with so many good dual threat quarterbacks, it's easy to like kind of lose perspective on each of them individually at times. I mean, like, if not for, like, if Lamar Jackson didn't play in this era, I think Josh as a runner would probably get more we all know it gets a lot of attention, but it's just so freaking effective. I mean, on the season, he carried the football 111 times. Of the quarterbacks who actually ran a fair amount, he finished first in success rate. So 67% of his runs were successful. He ran for 45 first downs. Next Gen Stats has this first down over expected. So like what would, you know, the expected first down based on where the defenders are in the blocking. And he's second only to Hurts, but Hurts has the tush push that kind of bolsters those stats. He is a fearless runner who actively seeks out contact and is too physical for most DBs to handle, frankly. And it just really changes the math for defenses. And it's something, I mean, I'm going to talk about a lot with Kansas City, but that 52-yard run was a all-out blitz. They were playing man-free. When he escapes, you're effed. That's why you can't do that a lot of the times. You know, yeah. I mean, you have to, it's situational, but he's just a load, dude. Like, I mean, did you, like, how many quarterbacks would you even compare to him as a runner, his style, historically?
I think, you know, I've been a fan of Bomani Jones for a long time, and he said it when he first came out, and he called him Jaheim Allen. I forget. But it was to allude to, he is a unique individual, but his closest comp was Cam Newton as far as a runner. That people do not understand how big he is. I played in Buffalo at the beginning of the season in 2018. People don't understand just the thickness. He's a thick boy, multiple C's of Josh Allen. And when I think he's also kind of like this, you know, Marvel superhero that's realized, I need to protect myself during the regular season And when it gets cold and when it's nut cutting time, excuse my language, I know that I have an absolute advantage when teams want to turn their back and play man, or when there's 1 yard, 2 yards deep. Cam Newton was the most unstoppable 4th-and-1, 3rd-and-1 weapon that there was. And Josh Allen, in a different degree, the play, there aren't called QB runs like they did with Cam Newton per se, but Josh Allen has decided, I'm going to turn some of these into called QB runs because ultimately I'm going to fall forward. Ultimately, your linebackers, your safeties, and your corners have, or sometimes undersized to me by 20, 30 pounds, have to try to bring me down. Oh, by the way, I mentioned this on Twitter during the game. He's starting to spam this gray area where we still want to protect quarterbacks as runners. You know, we got on Kenny Pickett doing the fake slide. He's playing with the gray area in the open field of guys not wanting to hit him in the head area, wanting to be too physical, but he's 245 pounds with a head of steam. All right, then I'm going to go and try to tackle him. Oh, yeah, he can kind of juke me out. He can hit me around. Like, he's unbelievable, and I think it's clicked in his head. He's like, until the refs stop me, I'm going to spam this Super Mario until I get to the final stage. And, like, I don't know what you do because these linebackers that we drafted and we developed to cover the Travis Kelce's of the world, to cover these slot receivers of the world, they're all running back. They're on their heels, and then like, oh, this guy, Behemoth, is coming at me. And until he crossed the line of scrimmage, he's pump faking. Oh, he could still maybe throw the ball. And then he crossed the line of scrimmage. Oh, if I go and really try to tag him as a runner, he slides because he's still athletic. Mm-hmm. He baits this, illegal, or what's it called? Personal foul against me, against the player. And he's just toying with people. And he's like, I threw 18 interceptions in the regular season, but that was just me like, how do I just get to the postseason? Ultimately, when they've gone his runs and when they were 6-6, he's just like, how do we just get to the postseason feel? And they've been in the postseason for 2 months now.
Yeah. He checks down to his feet, basically. It's just the truth. And you make a great point about the mental aspect of it and the rule. And he is a guy who also like calls for flags, you know, like that's just him and Mahomes both do. They're both like the two greatest quarterbacks right now. They both do it. So neither of your fan bases can get mad at me.
Got mad at LeBron for like, you know, not mad at him, but they said when you're a superstar, you've got to get to the point where you're not, there's no guilt or shame in being like, hey, I'm elite. People aren't going to call fouls on me or throw flags unless I really kind of just like ask for them. And he's gotten to that point where he's like, all right, there's no, I don't care what you think of me. I'm just going to do it. There's no fine for flopping. There's no fine for faking it. And he's figured that part out for sure.
But I love your point about the linebackers. You know, across the league, there are a lot of teams where they do lack the size and physicality to stop them. The Chiefs are a little different. They have Nick Bolton's he's a thumper. Chenault's a thumper. They've got really physical DBs. So I'll get into that more for that matchup. But in this matchup, his legs were a huge difference for them in this game. Pittsburgh eliminated after squeaking into the playoffs. What is your pick for the Wolf for the Steelers?
The Wolf is just leadership of the Steelers. And I'm not talking about Mike Tomlin. Mike Tomlin, who we just saw walk off the podium and ask about his job.
Well, he also just said there or somebody reported that he's coming back.
Yeah, and I was gonna say that. Like that was just him not wanting to deal with a reporter kind of trying to drive a wedge, I'm sure, in his mind. Because he could be matter of fact like that. He's earned that right to some degree. I'm not talking about him. I'm talking about what they do at their leadership position, which we all know as the quarterback, that's the loser because you have a guy in Kenny Pickett who you spent a draft pick on, and you knew that there would be some development there. He wasn't a surefire thing. We understand that, but you've been a subpar team with him at the helm. He's not processing well. He is inaccurate, and he has not gotten better. And so you have a worry that a guy like Mason Rudolph can come in execute the offense and at least give you contention as an offense. You know, you're leaning on your run a little more, but he's making simple reads that you're like, Kenny Pickett, that's the stuff that we needed you to do if we're going to take a step.
Yeah,
we talk about Mike Tomlin always having a winning record, but eventually that Super Bowl that you won is over a decade in the rearview mirror, being just above 500. Ultimately, you know, what does that mean? And you can't do that. We now know with the AFC, especially stacked the way it is, without a game-changing quarterback. And so, do you spend more draft capital on a quarterback this year? Are you even positioned to? Do you hope that Kenny Pickett makes a leap, which he hasn't shown you to? Mason Rudolph can't be your long-term answer. No. And so, without all those things, you are really just you're designated to just be mid. And like mid, and when you're with a winning record is fun to say about Mike Tomlin, because we all respect him as a coach and a leader of men, guys like Ryan Clark who laud him all the time and rightfully so. But having no shot at making real Super Bowl noise, to me, wears thin really quickly. And, you know, he's going to be there. He said he's going to be there. If you're that ownership, you're the most patient ownership in the NFL, as evidenced by your history and coaching hires. But what do you do without the game-changing quarterback? Your running back, Najee Harris, has proven that he can't be an every-down back, either from health or his production. So you've got a 1-2 punch with them. I like them a lot. Their offensive line has changed over the years, but you know, and they've actually had a pretty decent year. But you had to fire your offensive coordinator mid-season, who was doing some Brian Johnson, just why are we running two goes and an option route in the middle and not – getting our guys and giving them options. So, but then, you know, Sullivan, the guy who stepped in, he's done a little bit of better job, but what do you point to if you're Pittsburgh to say, outside of TJ Watt, we are elite here. We can make a run here and we're set up for the future here.
Yeah. I think with Tomlin, and by the way, you said, you know, you had to fire him in season. Well, it was Tomlin's mistake to retain him by Canada that long. And that falls on him. And, you know, I've complimented some of the things I've seen from the offense in the last few weeks. I think the run game has kind of figured things out. You know, I talked about a little bit what they're doing with multiple tight ends when they, you know, they started using a little bit more 13 personnel, play action off of that. It became like a more functional offense, but it's still not good enough. It is mid. They have talented young players on both sides of the ball. Joey Porter Jr., Broderick Jones this year. You know, there's the foundation of something, but as you said, there's – until they figure out the quarterback, and not just the quarterback, the offense. Yeah. I mean, as we talk about all these like incredibly creative, fun offenses around the NFL, if you're not competing in that way, you're never going to compete with Joe Burrow and Lamar Jackson. And I think that's ultimately like where I come down on the Tomlin. It made sense to me that he returned, and I didn't think that they should fire him or anything like that. However, if he goes into next year with only Kenny Pickett and Mason Rudolph at quarterback, then I think you actually can have that conversation, because that would be a pretty crucial error. I thought he was fine. They were right to give Pickett a chance this season. I understand that. Obviously, he got hurt, but then he wasn't playing as well. Yeah, you know, whatever. They give him the look. It's fine. You can't go into next season without at least bringing in legitimate competition at the position for all the reasons we said. Now, their pathways to doing so are limited. They're picking not, you know, the top of the draft. So we're talking about, you know, your Kirk Cousins's, your Russell Wilson's, your Justin Fields's, all of which are interesting options and that I think cheap. They should consider. Not cheap.
Not cheap options. And, you know, I'm starting to come around on having some sympathy for, you know, we people kind of got on George Pickens and Deontay Johnson for kind of throwing fits and bad body language, but you study the offense and you study the looks that where Kenny Pickett misses them wide open, or Matt Canada has them running 9 routes into cover 4, and you can see why both those guys are just like fed up. And yeah, they're young and maybe they don't have the right to express that as vividly and openly in public, but they're literally two dynamic playmakers I think most teams would like to have on their team who aren't getting the ball in creative ways. And they're showing it and being young. And I now come around to empathizing and sympathizing with them. I'm like, I get it.
Yeah. All right. What is your winner from Rams Lions?
It's got to be Detroit everything. It's just got to be.
Everything?
The city, everything? The ownership. I know. Well, I mean, we'll dial it down to Dan Campbell. Shout out Glen Rose, Texas. That fan base. I mean, you saw the guy with the tears. It's just everything. It's just a long time coming. And as a former Packer, it was enjoyable beating up on the Lions every year. It was just kind of a Thanksgiving game every other year that you got to look forward to. But as passionate and loyal of a fan base as there is, that stadium, when it's rocking, is this incredible home atmosphere. And just the way that Dan Campbell has put together this team, he was hired. They trusted him. He then hired former players. He trusted them. There's a clip going around of him, and I think in spring or training camp, asking the players to trust that you were doing this for a reason. Mm. That many former players who have felt the aches and pains of 2-a-days, felt the aches and pains of, you know, later week padded practices, he gets it. And it's like he says in the clip, listen, there's a certain level of this that we have to have. We got to be able to tackle. We got to bring physicality. But I know when to take my foot off the gas. I know what you're going through. I know how to make you guys get to game day with all of your ducks in a row, feeling as best as you can. And that buy-in has taken just an incredible process of trust where the first year, yes, they struggle. The second year, knocking on the door, you see bits and pieces of what they're building. And this third year, actually breaking through and breaking that curse. And now with looking like they're going to be in the NFC Championship, you know, barring just a wild performance by Tampa. We can talk about that. But I give everything, all the credit to Detroit, because, you know, it's easy to just kind of accept that there's, you know, a curse. We don't believe in really curses, wink, wink, but accept that that's just how things are going to be. Hire the same old kind of retread coach. Make sure that that coach hires their same old retread coordinators. But no, you've got Aaron Glenn, who's getting head coaching interviews. Ben Johnson, yeah, who got promoted from tight end, who's getting head coaching interviews. Deuce Staley as a coach. Kelvin Shepard. I mean, all up and down, ex-players who aren't just there because they're ex-players, who Dan Campbell trusts, and you can see the way that they tackled. I mentioned while this game was happening, it's not often you can feel the physicality, and football is physical no matter what. Any Sunday, it's physical. It was especially felt this game, the way that they were coming downhill, pursuing on defense, tackling. You could tell that they have full buy-in all over the place. You trade for a guy like Chauncey Gardner-Johnson, who's just, you know, he's one of those guys where you always want to be able to pull a guy back instead of telling him to sick him. He's a guy you have to pull back, but he's bringing physicality. He's filling rush lanes, and he's talking his crap. And I absolutely respect that. And then lastly, the way they've built in the draft. I mean, the hits in the last 3 years, you've got arguably 4 all-pro caliber guys, a tackle, you know, a guy in Jahmyr Gibbs who's going to continue to ascend. We're still not sure about Jameson Williams, but he's speedy. I'm on St. Brown. I mean, I'm on Raw. I mean, they have been such an
ranch.
Hutchinson, I mean, the hits they've had on via the draft, I mean, that type of stuff is how you build something sustained. And it's almost like literally their ascent has been a thing of blueprint heaven, where teams are like, when we rebuild, this is how we want it to go. The first year, you take your bruises, you stink. The second year, you start knocking heads, you show your physicality, you don't have the talent yet. The third year, you're either on the cusp or you break through. It's like a thing of dreams for Detroit and for any team who's looking to rebuild like that.
Yeah, and they did it all with a quarterback who was seen as done, who was a throw-in, a salary dump. I think I'll just say this. I'll keep it quick because we're going a little bit long. What I love about Campbell is he is confident in what he knows his team does well, and he has never wavered on that. Like with the fourth down stuff, it's like, okay, it's one thing to do that when you're losing and you're just desperate, but when you're the favorite, when you're to win the division, when you're seen as a dominant team, to still stick to that identity, like even in the disaster at the end of the Dallas game with the 2-point tries, you know, people, maybe you, I understood it's the third time or whatever he did it, you know, some criticism, but on the other hand, I was like, this is just who this guy is. And he has always been this guy. And on that final drive, after Sean McVay punted it back to him on that second down, when he put the ball in Jared Goff's hands and asked him to throw it. Throwing. I freaking loved it.
Yes.
I loved it because not only did it indicate that he had faith in Goth to execute, and that, you know, that's a throw he's made to Amon-Ra St. Brown a million times in the middle of the field, but also he recognized, hey, my offensive line, which is healthy now and was excellent in this game, will hold up. Mm. Jonah Jackson locked down Aaron Donald on that rep. You know, the Rams sent like a five-man pressure, and Campbell leaned on the strength of the team, which is their pass protection, their offensive line, and they rewarded him. And I love that he did that. It was an awesome win for the city. Awesome all around. Awesome. I thought the defense really outplayed expectations in a number of ways. That they were super good in the red zone. That's going to matter a lot moving forward.
Because you know, story of the game was red zone.
Yeah,
touchdowns. That's it.
Well, so I'll just use my woof before we take a break. It's actually kind of what I hinted at. I wrote, because with the Rams, it's like they were the team also, like, you know, they nobody thought they would get here. So it's hard to ding them. Really outperformed on defense in particular, I think, given that most, you know, it's like a lot of new rookies and unknown players, you know, I think for this game, you know, it's a little nitpicky, but I wrote Sean McVay, the game manager. Mm. Sean McVay, brilliant coach, brilliant play caller, I think a brilliant leader. However, he did some things in this game that I think do stand in contrast to the stuff I said about Dan Campbell. And I'm not talking about just like fourth downs or whatever, although I don't, the punt. So at the end, he punted. I mean, more egregious than the punt, I would say, is the use of timeouts earlier that led them to that situation, which is bad. I thought it was odd, too, that they didn't even try with a minute left in the first half. And he had all of his timeouts that then. That was another thing.
It wasn't like you have a second-year quarterback in a line that's
right. You're the Rams. You're so explosive. What, you're not going to try? You know, I thought that was weird. And then the punt at the end, you know, 4-14, that's debatable. But at that point, you're already in there like 44. So it's like you're not playing the field position. I mean, I didn't really understand that either. So ultimately, he has a history of being sort of conservative sometimes with game management. And I thought in this particular game, it kind of bit him.
Yeah, absolutely. And the red zone speaks to that. And, you know, you have an end around to Puka Nacua. It looks like they're forcing the ball to Cooper Kupp and Nacua in the red zone.
Yes.
Who are incredible receivers in the open field. But when that field gets shrunk in the red zone, they do not have the separation that you need from just like a quick twitch caliber. It just doesn't feel like those guys thrive in that situation, especially in the playoffs when teams really, they're bracketing you. Everywhere you look, those two guys have four plus eyes on them. And so, you know, the Detroit was incredible against the run all day. And so I think Sean McVay felt like he didn't have that as an option, even though Kyle Williams was incredible all year. He's walking around and whatever was wrapped around his hand, you can't trust that. And so, yeah, it felt like he lost himself a little bit when they got in the red zone. And that's the story of the game. Detroit stayed physical. They pounded the rock in the red zone and they ran it up the gut at Aaron Donald, who, you know, from an offensive line perspective, you could tell, as everyone does, the whole point was putting a red dot sight on that guy. And they were sliding to him. They had any guy who was free. He checked his down line and he made sure the momentum was stopped and he looked for 99. And, you know, teams all try to do that, but to do that effectively, it's got to be a concerted effort from all five offensive linemen, the running backs who chip on their way out, and the tight ends who chip on their way out, and the protections that you call. And so doing that versus a guy like that, and guess what? He's still going to win. They're still going to scheme him one-on-ones, but to keep him in check all game was an incredible feat. And you do that by running at him a little bit more, running the ball, sustained drives, and then scoring and making the Rams – try to catch you from behind in that way.
I love your point about the red zone generally in the Rams. I think that's something I underestimated going into this game, because I looked at this Rams offense and they're so explosive and the wide receivers are so good. And I thought they're going to cook this Detroit secondary. They're not good. The corners are not good. No. And that was true in the field. Right. Yeah. But when things tightened up and that space became constricted, and I was watching, you know, some of the things you described, you know, the Lions run defense is actually good and it has been good. And then when, you know, Kupp and Nacua didn't have all of that grass to work with and things got a little bit tighter, Detroit was able to get after Stafford, some timely blitzes. I thought the blitz branch and got, I think, the forced incompletion. They didn't get him. But that advantage dissipated in that part of the field. And that's going to be, I think, relevant, especially, again, they're facing another team with two very, very good wide receivers and a worse running game than Los Angeles in Tampa. And I think that you might see that same dynamic play out where it's kind of like a bend, don't break on defense.
Yeah, and to add on McVay, too, and how he kind of changes a little bit, they're a team and an offense that motions and shifts pre-snap. I'll say without looking at the stats, 8 out of 10 times, I mean, that is their MO. And you felt in certain situations, he just overthought it. On third downs and crucial moments, they went static. And there was even one, I think it was third, fourth quarter where they're going in, where they quick snapped, it looked like, the Detroit Lions. They took what they thought was one-on-one coverage against Cooper Kupp on Chauncey Gardner-Johnson. Matt Stafford throws kind of this back shoulder kind of high fade towards the pylon, and they rushed that. They didn't send anyone in motion, and they didn't do it, the things that they were doing to get guys open, and it felt like he just completely abandoned the success of what he had because he overthought. Like, he was trying to chess move it two steps ahead, and he kind of stumbled over his own feet for no reason. It felt like an unforced error to not do what you were doing to reveal for Matt Stafford and the whole offense what Detroit was trying to do, which led to so much success earlier in the game.
That's a great point. Still a great season for the Rams. A lot to build on. They found a lot of young talent. They're set up.
The cap space. They hit on the draft. Give Les Snead some money. Let him cook. I like where they're heading. Yeah.
All right. Well, provided that Stafford, you know, keeps playing. Sure. But anyways, onward with the Lions. Let's take a quick break and come back, and we'll start with another NFC North team.
Why should you bet with Caesars Sportsbook? Two words, Caesars Rewards. Every bet brings you closer to the types of benefits only Caesars can offer. Hotel stays, VIP experiences, sports and concert tickets, and more. It's not just an app, it's an empire. 21 and older must be physically present in Arizona, Colorado, Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, Kansas, Louisiana, Maryland, Massachusetts, Michigan, Nevada, New Jersey, New York, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Tennessee, Virginia, West Virginia, Wyoming, or Washington, D.C. Sports betting is void in Georgia, Hawaii, Utah, and other states where prohibited.
Know when to stop before you start. Gambling problem? Illinois, Maryland, New Jersey, Ohio, Tennessee, Virginia, West Virginia, Pennsylvania, affiliated with Harris, Philadelphia. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem, crisis counseling referral services can be accessed by calling 1-800-GAMBLER, 1-800-426-2537. Or in Maryland, visit mdgamblinghelp.com. West Virginia, visit 1800gambler.net. Arizona, call 1-800-NEXT-STEP. Colorado, D.C., Nevada, Wyoming, Kansas, affiliated with Kansas Crossing Casino, call 1-800-522-4700. Indiana, call 1-800-9-WITH-IT. Iowa, call 1-800-BETS-OFF. Louisiana, call 1-877-770-STOP. Licensed through Horseshoe, Bossier City, and Harris, New Orleans. Massachusetts, if you or a loved one is experiencing problems with gambling, please call 1-800-327-5050 or visit gamblinghelplinema.org for 24/7 support. Michigan, call 1-800-270-7117. New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369.
This podcast is proud to be supported by Jet's Pizza, the number one pick in Detroit-style pizza. Why? It's simple. Jet's is better. With the thickest, crispiest, cheesiest Detroit-style pizza in the country, there's no competition. And I have to say, speaking from experience recently, having tried it for the first time in Detroit, it is absolutely delicious. Right now, you can get $5 off any 8-corner pizza with code 8SAVE. That's the number 8, S-A-V-E. Go to jetspizza.com to learn more and find a location near you. Again, try Jet's signature 8-corner pizza and get $5 off with code 8SAVE. That's number 8, S-A-V-E. Jet's Pizza. Better because it has to be.
Okay, so Packers-Cowboys. On the Green Bay side, there's so many people you could pick. Jordan Love was amazing, but the person I want to focus on is Matt LaFleur, who listeners to this pod know I've always been like very high on. I was very high on him as a play caller. It was with Aaron, and people were like, how much is this is Aaron? How much is LaFleur? I think he's excellent. I thought in this game, his total master, like the combination of him and Love, but what he's been doing all year was just dramatically on display. You know, again, Love was amazing. He made some really cool throws under pressure. You saw him do all the things he's been doing all season. But when you see guys just not even open, not even wide open, so open, they look like fans who have run onto the field. Luke Musgrave is just like, get me here. I'm here. That's the play caller. It's the play caller and it's the defense, you know, struggling it, but it is the play caller, I think, taking advantage of some of the defensive's tendencies, some inabilities to adjust. Really what it flows from is the, all of the motion that they use and then the run action and the defense's vulnerability to that run action. Everything kind of comes from each other. Why is Luke Musgrave wide open? Well, he's wide open because the Cowboys are very concerned about things happening in the backfield. Why are they concerned about things happening in the backfield? Well, the Cowboys literally don't have, like, they have to play dime constantly because, and that's a personnel thing on their front. But so when Green Bay comes out with these multiple tight ends, they can, and they did run all over them. Aaron Jones was wonderful, and you end up in this situation where the whole defense is being pulled on a string to try to stop the run or whoever is leaking into the flat or whatever, and then they just lose guys. And yeah, it was just the story of the game for me. It started from the open. I love that they started with the football too, which is something that LaFleur did to the Lions as well. It is not, of course, common practice. Usually if you win the coin toss, you receive in the second half, so you have the opportunity to double dips, you know, if you're, but I think with one, first of all, from the second half of the season on, Jordan Love had the best QBR in the NFL on opening drives. The Packers ranked second in EPA per play, only behind the San Francisco 49ers. But I think it was so important, Marshall, in this game in particular, because all season long, the story with the Dallas Cowboys has been, if you fall behind to them, you're screwed because you can't run the ball and you can't threaten the run the way you can. So I think in this game, going into this game and saying, we're going to take the ball, we're going to score, and the script is never going to get away from us. We are always going to have that optionality against your sus run defense. Loved it. So anyways, so much to love about what the offense did, but I thought LaFleur was just completely in control of the entire game.
The moral of the show so far with leadership and LaFleur, you know, is into that, is in 2024, it's about self-awareness, knowing who you are, knowing what you do well, and using that to the best of your ability. And Matt LaFleur went into this game understanding what Dan Quinn likes to do, their limitations from a personal standpoint. Dan Quinn likes to run a lot of man. That's why they go get corners like Stephon Gilmore and you know, Trevon Diggs and replace them with Deron Bland, guys who you trust in one-on-one, who can go be ball hawks, that allow you to play one high over, allow you to kind of box everything in, rush the passer, and be very dynamic on defense. Well, Matt LaFleur is like, all right, that's fine, but do you want to run across the field all day long knowing that Micah Parsons isn't – we're not going to let him just rush like it's – one-on-one pass rush in practice like this. We're just not going to let you do that. And it's funny in the regular season how much things change in the playoffs, and more people, you either become more of who you are, you lean in, or people kind of lose sight of what got them there. And LaFleur decided, hey, we're going to do what got us here. And it's funny you mentioned, I love that. That's a great point of, we still, this year has been the, who is Matt LaFleur really? Because yeah, when he got hired, the immediate first question is how are you going to be able to work with Aaron Rodgers, future Hall of Fame quarterback, Super Bowl winning quarterback, a guy who, as the years have gone on, I play with him, likes to be outspoken, likes to let people know what his opinion is about things and all matter of facts of life. And so you can tell that he is making a Frankenstein's monster with what he wants to do, with who they have, and with what Aaron has been accustomed to. This team this year runs more motion than Aaron would ever have liked. Aaron was not a guy who loved a lot of pre-snap motion. He liked things to be 3x1, 2x2, very, very simple. And he could manipulate you with a snap count. He could take matchups that he wanted. But his general thing of being under center and having a tight end come across the field and run a naked boot, that's not what he preferred to do on a play-in and play-out basis. And We did that some when we were in Green Bay and we took shots. But generally, as things progressed, he wanted to be in gun. He wanted to see the whole field. Jordan Love, as a young quarterback, this is – people forget, and maybe they do or they don't, but I think people forgotten this is like his rookie year. This is his first full year starting, and so the first half, he was okay. The offense was okay. They had, you know, some good wins, some wins that you're like, all right, there's something here, something here. Then they had some stinkers, and I think that Pittsburgh game was a turning point week nine. Ever since then, Jordan Love has 21 touchdowns and one.
Fire.
21 and one since then. And so they have found who they are. And you talk about being in 12 personnel, 13 personnel, making Dan Quinn's defense try to match, because ultimately before there's ever even a pass play or these deep explosive gains, you've got to make sure your run fits are solid. You've got to make sure you have enough bodies to account if Green Bay wants to run zone or duo or these pitches. You've got to make sure all that stuff's accounted for. And so you have guys who are outmatched personnel-wise who are thinking, oh, Aaron Jones is back. He's got juice. He's not some schlub at running back. We've got to respect this. And then you run play action on first down when guys are still trying to get a feel for what the drive's going to look like. And then you get Luke Musgraves, who's over there by the water boy, like, hey, guys, on that throwback, stuff like that. And then when all that's said and done, they've hit you on a bunch of those. Then it's do or die. It's got to have it. Jordan Love's in shotgun. Yeah. And he's throwing darts down the seam to your guy trailing. And it's that I remember seeing that play on replay kind of redesigned. And you're like, the obvious read is Jalen Reed coming across. He runs this little kind of Texas kind of a clear out route. But the real play was Jordan Love seeing they have no safety help over top. It's me and my guy, and I'm going to lay it up and put it in a perfect spot with off platform with a guy in my face. And you're like, okay, he's here. They're here.
That's really, there are so many similarities between his performance and Stroud's performance. But it is like, they're both like operating. The scheme is working and guys are open. And then there are these moments where they elevate with crazy gutsy throws. They're seeing the field well. Jordan Love he's gotten really good at identifying matchups in the way you just described. You've seen that progress over the course of the season. But, you know, the scheme, you talked about how with Rodgers, you know, there was an aversion to motion and some of the under center play action stuff. And it felt at times like him and LaFleur were in conflict, or, you know, they're certainly, I mean, an MVP season, so that I wouldn't mischaracterize it by
both
saying
can be
they
true.
Were always in
both
conflict.
Can be true.
But there it was a marriage of ideas, whereas now we're seeing, oh, Matt LaFleur is running the exact offense he wants to. I mean, Jordan Love had an over 50% play action rate in this game. The bulk of that was under center. Mm-hmm. Aaron Jones running under center ran for 107 yards and two touchdowns. It's a 56% success rate, which is extremely good. It's all clicking together in a way that is very frightening. It's frightening for any defense, but it's especially frightening when you're a defense like Dallas that we know, you know, struggles against multiple tight ends on the field, struggles to stop the run, has struggled to stop the run all season. If you can just line up under center, you're going to put them in compromised situations, and that's what we saw in this game. And like you're – well, let's get to Dallas, actually.
Sure.
Yeah. I feel like the Eagles' embarrassment kind of took the heat off of Dallas a little bit. But what is your woof, the Cowboys?
My woof is – listen, I grew up in Dallas. My cousin Robert Newhouse played for the Cowboys. There is an affinity in my heart somewhere deep down for the Cowboys. And my woof is Jerry Jones. My woof is an owner who is seeing his baby, his toy, his thing that he loves so dearly, just not work out anymore. And we won't get morbid about, you know, the passages of life and all that stuff and what this means to him. But you have a guy that you hire, Mike McCarthy. He goes 42-25. It's nothing to shake a stick at. But if you're Jerry Jones, you need and want more. And to see that happen and to fall apart in such a dramatic way at home, you find a diamond in the rough in Dak Prescott. He's played an incredible season. The people who want to, you know, he's had a bad game and he's had poor games versus really good defenses and good teams. So that's a legitimate criticism of Dak Prescott. But the season he's had has been a really good season. It's been – and so the people that, A, you want to get rid of him, A, you can't. You owe him too much money. But B, in this life, in this game, when you're getting rid of coaches and coordinators and primetime players, you not having a plan for what to replace him with, to me, is the big part of it. So, you get rid of Dak after the next year. Who are you going to go? Like, who's going to replace him and give you what you need? So I think Dak is their guy. He's got to be their guy, honestly. But it's tough that Mike McCarthy, you know, he took his time off. He hired analytics people to really dive deep into what he was missing and how to round out his coaching style and his leadership style. And what we end up with is Dak Prescott in shotgun running all go special.
It's throwback, man. It's, and especially in contrast to, you know, I mean, when you look at the top, the teams that have made it, it's all these Shanahan guys. I mean, it's not all of them, but you know, we talked about Detroit, we talked about Houston, we talked about Green Bay, the Rams, you know, or who like the Niners are coming in, like, and then you watch the Eagles. It's very different. The Eagles is obviously a totally different offense. They run that sort of power spread offense. The Cowboys, it's more of this West Coast. It's the stuff Mike McCarthy's been doing forever with some, you know, there's some motion, there's some modifications, but you, it's not like everything we were talking about with Green Bay. But the tricky thing is, Marshall, Dak is more like Rodgers than these young court. Like he's good at a lot of things, but one of his greatest assets is similar to Rodgers, the you know, he just want the mental mastery side of it, right? Like he doesn't need to be babied.
Right.
But
maybe he kind of does. Just,
yeah, well, maybe it would help against
I think it's ultimately not about, you know, blanket statement needs to be babied or given stuff, but you need to, like, I think as an offensive coordinator, if I was ever going to do this, I'm looking for my quarterback, whether he's a rookie or he's a 15-year vet, I'm looking to give him 5 to 10 no-brainer plays a game. Take some load off of, here we go, I got to drop back and process, you know, four wide versus, is this cover six? Is this three invert? Is this, you know, whatever this is, because that's difficult. Over and over, these defenses have adjusted, and there's a lot of offensive coordinators that are adjusting back to, hey, under center, we're going to, you know, we're going to disguise our run and pass game, make them look similar. We're going to, you know, Jordan Love only threw the ball 21 times. We're not going to try to drop back and throw the ball 60 times, because the less times we're dropping back, that's less times a pass rush is going to win. That's less times my quarterback has to process the entire field. And yeah, that's what we pay him for. But if you take a little bit off of that load off his shoulders, your team will be better for it. That means you got to coach a little bit differently. That means your Waffle House menu has to shrink by about 3 or 4 inches. So be it. But are we trying to win games here? Are we trying to go on runs? Are we trying to maximize the talent that we have right now? Not the talent we wish we had, not the scheme or the matchup we wish we had. The self-awareness of like, what's happening right now? And how do I cater all the people that I have, injuries, free agents, all this new guys that we signed 3 weeks ago that because we're beaten up and we're bloody. Like, to me, that is, there's a level of just like arrogance and a level of humility on either side of the spectrum of my way is the way, it'll work. We'll figure it out. It'll work itself out. And hey, I'm not above this process of like finding the weak spots, these little chunks. It's what's it called? Arbitrage. It's real time arbitrage in every aspect of the game. And there's coaches that don't see it that way.
And there's really a connective fiber with Philadelphia, and obviously they're, you know, division rivals meeting the same inglorious ends, even though schematically they're very different, both offense and defense, wildly different. But the problem is similar, which is both offenses are, we do what we do because we have better players, yep, offenses. And in Cowboys' case, it's oriented around Dak and CD. And that's just not working in the NFL right now. And then defensively, they actually, I think, both ultimately, look, by the end, Philadelphia had a million problems on defense, but both teams didn't have linebackers. Literally, Dallas like just ran out of them. And you know, when you look at that and you're like, okay, Leighton Vander Esch got hurt early in the season. You know, the Eagles lost N'Kobe Dean, but were they really, really like
before that,
banking on that? Yeah, like did you come in with enough depth? Because, and this is something I want to get into, I keep hinting at, you know, I do think off-ball linebacker is more important than it's been in a long time in the NFL, but it's especially important in the NFC. And we always think about that vis-a-vis San Francisco, but the Packers certainly showed, I don't think you can play the Packers unless you have good off-ball linebackers. Fortunately, San Francisco does, which will certainly help them in that regard. But you like a lot of these teams, you cannot play without talent at the second level. And I think when both Dallas and Philadelphia look back on their season, they'll see that it was a huge mistake to not be more invested in that position.
Yeah, we traditionally think about, you know, the prime cornerstone positions, and it's been repeated: corner, pass rusher, tackle, quarterback. But a linebacker like Fred Warner, who can fill holes, he can read and process really quickly. I think he is more akin to like a Luke Kuechly than anyone in the league right now. And oh yeah, he can cover your tight end in Tampa 2 down the seam across the field. He has to be dynamic. Anything less than that, and I'm either, if you're not a guy who's going to tackle in the hole, I'm going to run right at you. I'm going to get alignment up to the second level. I'm going to make you pay over and over again. Or if you can't run, I'm running my tight ends, who have also become freaks in front of our eyes, right at you with an option route. I'm going to let him play basketball, and I'm going to make your life miserable. And a guy like Fred Warner, who we now see, I think the value is that he is completely dynamic and worthy of his All-Pro honors because he's just different. And you need a guy like that. They obviously don't grow on trees, but especially if you're Dallas, if you lose your linebackers and you're weak in that position, it's barbecue chicken. A guy like Matt LaFleur sees that on film, and he's like, oh, I already know what I'm going to do. Yeah, the telestrator.
14, yeah. 33 or whatever, isn't it, felt? Like, it's just, yeah. It was, yeah. And that's the thing about Dallas, man. Like, yeah, if you'd won that game, great. San Francisco was going to beat you. They're never going to beat San Francisco in this current iteration. Yep. And I think just to kind of wrap this conversation, everything Dallas does this offseason has to be oriented to how do we not get our ass kicked by the Niners. And this team would have gotten their ass kicked by the Niners. Okay, they did in the regular season. Yeah. They would have gotten their ass kicked by the Niners again in the playoffs. It's very hard for me to imagine that not happening with their current build. So they need to really change their identity. Because success for this team, and you're right, I think, in saying Jerry Jones is a loser, is making it to the Super Bowl, and they're not going to make it to the Super Bowl unless they can get over the boogeyman. Okay. Let's move on to Dolphins, Chiefs. I'll go first with my woof.
Okay.
It's Tua Tagovailoa, who had one of his worst games, really struggled in the cold weather. It's very similar to games where he struggled in the past. Middle of the field throws aren't there. Some cases he's sailing them because of pressures. Arm strength commonly becomes a factor in terms of not just throwing downfield, but throwing outside the numbers. Lack of second reaction ability comes to the fore. Now, I think that conversation that I want to have about it is the one that you're already seeing on the shows, but it's one that I don't really know, have an answer to, Marshall, which is I'm still trying to figure out what I think Miami should do with him and his contract. You know, you're going into the fifth year option year, but the Miami needs to do a contract for cap space. They don't have to, but it would certainly help them to open up some cap space. So if you do a long-term contract, you can sign to a big signing bonus, push that money down the road. You know, Christian Wilkins is up. There's some other players. He's probably the best one. I have gone back and forth on this because I don't think it's easy. I don't think it's easy because your likelihood of upgrading from him is not high. I truly believe that. And some of that is, you know, they're not, if they were picking first overall, we'd be like, yeah, sure, whatever. Yeah. They're not, yeah. Obviously. And when you talk about guys who would replace him, it's not evident to me that they would be better. Mm. However, I do also think you are seeing a ceiling or a wall, and I wonder whether he will ever get past those things that I just talked about. So I think that Chris Greer, their GM, is just in a very, very difficult spot. What would you do?
You know, gosh, I don't think anyone can answer, but like I pay him. I do that as soon as possible. But I don't inhibit getting out of it in 2 to 3 years, because you're right. He's just, what we've seen is that he has very hard limits on what he can do. And this game proved that without ideal scenarios and ideal situations, what we're talking about with Jordan Love and CJ Stroud that we're seeing, and now they have a whole career to play out, but they are guys who will take the scheme, the base level of whatever they're doing, and then yeah. they can elevate on top of it.
In moments. Yeah. Similar scheme too, by the way. Similar DNA.
Yeah.
It's such a great comp.
Yeah.
It's such a great comp.
What we saw was Tua was like, if things weren't perfect for him, listen, when he was at Alabama, he looked pretty fairly athletic. I think truly that hip injury has inhibited any kind of escapability and extending the play that he might have had in him. Because you're seeing him run, you know, there's nothing downfield. He's gone through 1, 2, 3 reads, and he's going to scramble to try to get something, get out of bounds or whatever. And it looks labored, and it looks slow. And, yeah, it's -22-degree wind chill, but guess who else was running around extending plays? Patrick Mahomes. He was doing it himself. So it wasn't like that was the most inhibiting thing ever.
Yeah.
No one likes that cold. It makes everything, you know, cinch up. But Tua, I was like, after the year we went through – last year and the year before with his head and the way he was taking hits, every time he runs and it looks like there's going to be contact, I'm still kind of like not sure, you know, what's going to happen. Now he put on weight. Maybe that's part of it to protect him from these hits. He learned how to quote unquote fall. You know, I like to think there's like some dojo where it's like this falling school with like a,
I think
like
it's literally what he did. Say,
like, this is how you fall and roll or whatever. Is that what it is?
But, like a judo fall.
But more so than that, you know, even the ball to Tyreek, the touchdown, was underthrown by a lot.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, okay, that's the best play they had all season, all game. And before that, he had completed like 7 or 8 passes that looked – everything just looked strained. And Kansas City was doing some things. You know, Spags did his cover one little whirly dervish that everyone's talking about. That's
effed up.
It's effed up, but ultimately it's just spots. And as a quarterback, they know it's just spots. You ignore the numbers. If it ends up still too high, it's still too high. And Tua looked truly just like bewildered by that. And that to me was a sign of everything that happened before and to come. And if Mike McDaniels isn't able to scheme, you know, I looked at Tua's passing chart this year. All of the explosive plays are down the middle and to the right, mostly to Tyreek and Jalen. The entire left side of the field, if I'm a defense, I'm neglecting it. I'm not sure he can make a pinpoint pass, you know, 15 yards down on the left side of the field. And if Jalen Waddle and Tyreek Hill aren't full strength, I'm playing top down and I'm making Tua beat me over the middle with questionable arm strength and questionable accuracy in the cold. And then I'm making him think twice after Mike McDaniel schemes a perfect, you know, motion a guy open. That runs its course in the playoffs when things just aren't pretty, when they've had all week to just focus on what you've done for 17 weeks.
I think you mentioned Love and Stroud, and I think if you're a Dolphins fan, you watch those quarterbacks and the contrast is evident and you start asking those questions. I was also thinking of another quarterback, which is Jared Goff, who, you know, people question whether how much he benefited from the McVay offense, and then that ran its course and McVay moved on in the same way that now it's being raised. Maybe like I saw, I don't remember if it was Steve Ruiz or someone put on Twitter, like, who's going to be Mike McDaniel's Matt Stafford, right? Like when he decides to like move on to a quarterback who can do more things on his
own. Made that situation with Goff untenable was the fact that they paid him league leading money. And so,
there's a parallel. However, Marshall, Jared Goff's in the divisional round now. Hey. He got right. So, but, and I think this is where the comp falls apart a little bit. Jared's limitations weren't arms. They weren't ability. They were play under pressure. Mm-hmm. And he still struggles.
That's still his weakness. Under pressure. Yes.
But you can control the situation if you have, as Detroit does, a very, very good offensive line. Whereas two of the limitations are more physical. Mm-hmm. So the question is, okay, well, how, and I think this is the same question you have to ask with your Jared Goffs, and Detroit is going to have to ask that question as they decide whether to pay him, by the way, and extend him. How long can we scaffold this?
Yeah.
You know, like how long can we maintain this situation? Because if you can tell me that you're always going to have Hill and Waddle, then I actually am like, great. Tua is a great quarterback to play with those players. But, you know,
Tyreek's about to be 30.
Guys get hurt. It's a tricky one. So I tend to take the cop-out answer that the devil is in the details. And if they could do a Jimmy Garoppolo style, to your point, like a two-year, like it looks big, but it's not that big, I think that would be palatable. But I have no idea what Tua wants and what they'll, if they'll draw a hard line. So that's
for me. I have a question for you.
Difficult.
Are we asking this same question in the same way? If Miami doesn't lose to Tennessee and beats Buffalo and has home field, are we – like, we assume this game goes differently, right?
Yes, and that's another.
But like, we also don't have this glaring case, right? That's fresh in our minds of him playing in the cold, and so.
But he's gonna have to play in the cold again
eventually.
To go back to what I was saying about the scaffolding, like Detroit, they can try to control. And they, by the way, having Jared Goff also can't play in the cold.
Yeah.
But they're able to keep him out of the cold.
Yeah.
All the way through, even if you go to San Francisco, it's not that bad. You know, you're in the AFC East, man. You're going to Buffalo. You're going to New York. You're going to New England. It's, I mean, I know, I understand that Detroit also plays with us, but I'm just saying, like, Kansas City, it's just, that has to factor into this too.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I hope that they can work out something like what we just said, because I think that's what's best for Tua. It's best for him to stay there. It's the best situation for him as a quarterback.
You can't discount feeling the way he's felt after the Brian Flores situation, like having a coach literally put his arm around you. I can speak from experience or lack thereof of when you feel like someone has bought into you and is invested in you, especially at that position, especially when what he came from. There's a tremendous value in that. And I'm not talking about taking tens of million dollars less value particularly, but a value in comfortability and a known. From Tua's side and from the Dolphins' side. Now, Tua's agent, agents aren't here for feel-good stories. They're not here for you to take less. The rest of the NFLPA doesn't want you to take less, especially as a quarterback. That's not how they want things to work. But if you're Tua, what is it worth being in a place like with a guy like Mac McDaniels that you could tell cares about you, is invested in like your growth as a man and like a leader? It's like the stark opposite of Brian Flores, who I'm not sure would have, you know, talked to him when he's getting a cup of coffee in the break room, so to speak. And what is that worth both to the Dolphins and to Tua, and how much off of, you know, we're looking at Derek Carr making upper 30, high 30 millions, Kirk Cousins in the 40s, Deshaun Watson, like the top, to be a top 10 paid quarterback, it's going to cost a lot.
It's a lot.
A lot of money.
And that's and it's one thing for Mike McDaniel, but it's literally the name I screw up the most. It's one thing for him to say, I believe in you and whatever, you know, and I truly believe it. I think he genuinely loves and respects
on
him.
On a rookie deal, yes.
On a rookie deal. I was gonna say things change very quickly. Yeah. And I can't imagine he was thrilled with the way things went down in Kansas City. Now he bears some of that responsibility too. I mean, I think the run game in particular needs to evolve in a way that it hasn't. Okay, speaking of Kansas City, I gave you them. You get to choose a winner.
Winner for me for Kansas City is kind of out of left field. To me, it's Steve Spagnuolo. That defense has carried them. All the talking points in the news goes with Mahomes and their lack of production. When are they going to put it together? They are who they are right now. This season, they have been who they have been. Their lack of a true number one that can get open for Pat outside of Travis Kelce has been apparent. It's not changing. We saw glimmers of hope with Rashee Rice. It feels like he's figuring it out. And, you know, God forbid they stop running him on over routes. Like, please just spam Rashee Rice running over routes and let him put the ball in his hands, let him get yak. But the Chiefs, who they are on offense, but Steve Spagnuolo has, you know, I remember he was our defense coordinator when I was with the Giants. And I really enjoyed him because you knew at the very least he was going to put pressure on the opposing offense. Now, sometimes that pressure was he blitzed seven guys and they hit you over the top. And maybe that was just like you didn't have the corner secondary ability to run that kind of stuff. But the controlled aggression of Spags and making you make a decision on offense, making you figure things out with under pressure, I always appreciated. And this defense has been keeping Kansas City afloat in a complete reversal of what they've been the last 5 years. And I give him all the credit in the world. Chris Jones has been playing lights out, even though he doesn't have the huge sack numbers. Charles Amenihu, I'll give him his praise. He's a guy.
This last game, he was huge in this last game.
Trained down here in Austin, a former UT guy who signed in Kansas City to play in games like this, as he has said. Lejarius Sneed, come on now. Like the clips of him just
the jam
jamming Tyreek Hill into the ground. Like people are gonna like see that and say, yeah, it's a good play. Like, no, do you understand how hard that is? Do you understand how difficult that is to do multiple times a game? I give Spags so much credit. They were ready. And the offense that that embarrassed people all year, they made them look pedestrian.
I love your point about the players because, you know, we love highlighting Spags' diabolical blitzes. The 2-to-1-to-2 coverage rotation was one of the funny – it was extremely funny. And he is a sensational individual game planner for all types of quarterbacks, all types of offenses. And we should talk about him the way I feel like Mike McDonald's gotten a lot of attention this year. Steve Spagnuolo is right there with him. Those two dudes are absolutely. And I don't know if, by the way, Spagnuolo's maybe he's not interested in being a head coach anymore. I don't know. But like, you know, if you want to improve your defense, certainly. But I also think he deserves a lot of credit for the development of these young players. Mm-hmm. You mentioned Amenihu. I was just watching George Karlaftis in this game. Yeah. That year 1-2 leap with him rushing the passer. I mean, he's always been very like physically strong, and he's got those like Marcus and I were talking about these like very violent hands, and he had those as a prospect. But in this game, particularly, you're seeing he's developing like a full set of tools, the pass rusher. He has a plan. He is affecting the quarterback in a way he did not last year. The young players in the secondary, they drafted in all rounds, you know, and later round guys are playing. Trent McDuffie's now one of the probably three best nickel corners in the NFL.
Get that coming.
yeah. And like, that's again, you know, like what they did was from a team building perspective, you know, Chris Jones is the guy on that defense, but there's so many young players on defense that they invested in at all points in the draft, and so many of them have developed and gotten better and better to the point where this is one of the best defenses in the NFL in the playoffs. Yeah. I mean, so yeah, I love that you picked Spags as your winner from this game. That's a great pick.
I think earlier in the season too, you know, again, all of the talk went to when is the Kansas City offense going to figure it out? Meanwhile, under the radar, the defense was just keeping them afloat.
Carrying them.
And we're like, all right, well, how much of this is, you know, just early season, you know, being disconcerted early in the season. But no, it was Spags and his scheme and his guys taking a leap. A guy like Nick Bolton, who is turned into one of those linebackers we talked about that – the five tool in baseball? You need multiple tools as a middle linebacker now. You just can't survive without one of those guys on your roster. And, you know, they've stayed pretty healthy as well, which is an incredible
thing on defense. Quite a contrast with Buffalo right now, by the way, I look ahead to that game.
Yep. This time of year, that's so important of just, you know, Buffalo, God bless him. I played with AJ Klein, just signed him 2 weeks ago off the street.
When they said his name, I was like, what?
He's familiar with the scheme, but like ultimately, like that's you know, that's going to be a problem in the next round. And so, yeah, give Spags all the credit. His defense has always been aggressive, But getting to be aggressive with guys who now are getting it and who are in their second, third year in the system is a whole nother ballgame.
100%. And that is, with the young, all the young players, it's definitely makes sense. More time, they've gotten better. They've gotten better at playing together. Even things like, I know, again, we're joking about the 2-1-2, but the ability to execute those disguises in coverage and the way the pressure works with the pass rush works with the coverage is spectacular. Okay, wrapping with Texans Browns, I want to end with a winner. So you give me your woof as Lenny walks in from the Brown side of the equation.
The woof is the big brown elephant in the room of what do you do now with Deshaun Watson? What do you do at the quarterback position?
I don't think they have a choice.
Or you just got replacement level play from Joe Flacco. Yeah. Off the street, and your quarterback who is owed another $140 million.
Ain't nothing you doubt of.
APY is just only going to go up, or you can kick the can and then get an $80 million cap hit 1 year. Like they're so hamstrung by him if he's not going to be any remote lever. And it's not even that he's been back middle tier. He's been demonstrably bad. And you give him the rust, excuse that first season he came back later in the year. They weren't necessarily in contention. And you're like, all right, let him play through it. Let him practice. Let him get back in the swing of things. Because taking a year and a half off of football is no joke. I debated when I was contemplating, hey, Lenny, what's up? Retirement. And it's just like there's just levels of rust that you can overcome and some that it's just difficult to be out for that long. And so you give him a little bit of leeway there. But the beginning of the season, his processing, it's not even, arm talent or whatever, his mobility in the pocket. Yeah. You're worried about what he's seeing pre-snap and post-snap and how he is actually implementing that in their offense. An offense that had Nick Chubb most of the year, unfortunately he got hurt. An offense that had, two incredible tackles in a bookending, a really, really good offensive line who you lose. So they've gotten hurt. And it's not been great, but Deshaun Watson was not taking – like this run that Joe Flacco had on, if Deshaun Watson's there, I'm not sure they're in the playoffs because of the way that he was playing, of what he showed us. And you're out of options. I'm not sure what you do.
I think it leaves them to your – like as you just laid out with just difficult questions. Why did this look so much better with the now 39-year-old off the couch? Is it – and if you're Kevin Stefanski, who was getting, coach of the year or buzz, we'll see what happens there. Is your offense just not well suited to the quarterback you brought in? Mm. And you at the beginning of the year, you saw there this attempt to kind of marry some of the styles. But then with Joe Flacco, he was able to call exactly the offense he wanted. In some ways,
This new player, David Njoku? Where was he for the first 10 weeks of the season? I'm just like, wait, what happened?
The play-action passing game was phenomenal in a way that it just wasn't with Watson. And you think, again, with like the healthy offensive line and Chubb, it should have been. And so I think that's just going to be another offseason of questions for them. But they don't, unlike some of the other teams we talked about, they don't have a choice. They made their bed. So anyways, it was a fun season for them. I feel like also like I gotta say it like this too, like for Browns fans who have not only not enjoyed Watson as a quarterback, but also like felt conflicted rooting for the team because of his baggage and the sexual assault allegations and harassment and all that. I know from talking to some of them, it was like a relief to have Joe Flacco as quarterback, not just because he was cooking, but it was like, great. I can watch this team and not have all these like weird mixed feelings about it. And the player versus the person and all that. And now you're just kind of back to where you were. So,
yeah. And then unfortunately that overshadows just an historic year for their defense, a defense that, by metrics was up there with kind of the Tampa Bay O2 defense and those Ravens defense. I mean, the way that they were playing was, you know, a defense that was leading to points in so many different ways. And you've got JOK, who's a traditional a box safety who we thought
so good.
We thought the game had phased those guys out. A safety who's operating like a linebacker and who's just really aggressive, but he makes a lot of tackles for loss. He's got an incredible vision and just decision making, and he's just firing through holes, and you love to watch him play. Myles Garrett, you know, being in just an incredible dynamic pass rusher who
keep giving serious football analysis while my dog gets in my face.
Lenny, are you is it
you know what you time? Signed up for?
He wants to go outside.
It's meal time. It's his meal time. Yeah. Okay. Well, okay. Maybe we'll use that as a moment to wrap here. So the Houston Texans obviously won the game. I mean, you could point clearly to CJ Stroud, who was wonderful, to Bobby Slowick, who I feel like if teams weren't interviewing for a head coach after watching this game, they probably and what he did to Jim Schwartz's the defense you were just talking about was quite a pantsing in some ways. Nico Collins, you could point to, who was awesome. He's been awesome all year, but it was awesome in this game against man coverage. But the winner that I wanted to single out is D'Amico Ryans, not as head coach, but what he has done with this defense, which has kind of been a little bit overshadowed by CJ Stroud being as amazing as he's been. And the defense has gone through some growing pains and they've had bad games. But what I loved about this performance from them was you saw some of the things you've seen all year in terms of the tackling, the rallying to the football, mm-hmm. which are very San Francisco-ish. But you also saw, I thought, some really smart play calling mm-hmm. and in-game adjustments. And I think with Ryan's, this was something he was very good at in San Francisco, and I don't know if he got enough credit for it because of the talent at his disposal. Now we're seeing him with there's definitely talent. I mean, you know, on this defense, but there are also holes, and I think he's done a fantastic job with the players he has. In this particular game, a couple of things, you know, this Texans defense has struggled to stop play action all year. I was very worried about that going into, you know, against the aforementioned Browns play action passing attack, and something you saw is they aggressively played the pass. Mm-hmm. Cleveland is not a good running team anymore. They weren't once Nick Chubb went out, and mostly because of offensive line injuries. Houston has a very good rushing defense. So on the season, the Texans played with very few light boxes. In this game, they bumped their light box rate to 70%, which on average for the season, it was 37, which is amongst the least. 70 would be at the top of the NFL. So I thought that was notable. In the first quarter, they were playing a lot of single high, 80% single high, but in the remaining three quarters, they switched to playing more split safety. Again, just smart in-game adjustments, recognizing that they were getting shredded when they had a single high safety, and then just timely pressures of the eight blitzes. They didn't blitz a lot, but of the eight blitzes they called, six resulted in pressures on Flacco, who threw for only 25 yards and 3.6 yards per attempt when blitz. So just top to bottom, really smart game planning, really smart adjustments, excellent performance from a defense under, of course, a defensive-minded head coach.
I love that. And like the ability to adjust and then trust your adjustments and not be so stubborn about it is an incredible point to make, because they were playing man. You could tell that they weren't going to respect the run. They're going to make Cleveland really like assert themselves in the run game. Cleveland playing with two backup tackles and someone who's not Nick Chubb. They're going to make you beat us there. And then they're going to play man. They're going to, for the first time, I think in most of the year, Derek Stingley is going to shadow a number one receiver. You saw him following Amari Cooper around and like, all right, we'll take one guy out. We'll try to erase him. And what that lead to, it led to some Njoku explosives. And they're like, all right. Njoku, who we haven't seen, you know, for most of the season, Joe Flacco seems to love him. And they're getting him open. They're scheming him open. That one down the seam. I mean, the safety was there. The safety just didn't think Njoku was going to run a 4-5 right by him. And so they did that. And then what did they do? They reverted to split safeties, more zone. And for a while there, Joe Flacco was shredding the zone, but shredding the zone at 6 yards, 7 yards a clip is something that I can live with. I can live with that all day long because, again, your backup tackles, I've got Will Anderson and Goddard, who are getting pressure. Yeah. Joe Flacco's not, his, you know, his time to release was high before that, and it got lower by almost, you know, half a second when they went to zone. And so that adjustment, it could have been easy to say, you know, listen, we practiced all week to play a lot of man. You guys have been working on it. Let's stick with that. Even with the explosive, you know, one, you can't score three touchdowns at once. They're not going to do all this. But he's like, no, we're going to completely shut down this offense and give them nothing to go to, and make Joe Flacco beat us, make two backup tackles beat us, and make someone other than Amari Cooper beat us. Right. And that's, to me, again, humility, the self-awareness thing of a guy who is not yet 40, who's leading his team, who's not afraid to say, you know what, this ain't working, scrap it. And I think it's a drastic difference in leadership styles. It's playing out in real time with these coaches. Yeah. And again, you don't want to say too much without knowing the inside of their brain and what they're talking about in the facility, but that's bearing itself out on game day. You can see it happen in real time. And that's all we have to go off of, is what you're choosing to do with the information that you've seen prior. And so I give them all the credit in the world for that.
Yeah. And such a great synopsis of the approach to Joe Flacco, because that's the Browns were killing people with explosives. So they said, you know what? Our four-man rush is better than your offensive line. Mm-hmm. And you got a quarterback who's going to throw us the football at some point. Let's be real. So let's just make him throw it a lot, and or not make him throw it a lot, but like, let's like just keep a lid on it. Tackle. They're good tacklers. And if there's a theme to this entire podcast as we come to an end, I think it is the difference between coaches who came into this weekend without humility, who said, we do what we do, versus I think all of the coaches and players, but who we've praised, have been the ones who have been willing to adjust their game plans or to lean to find schematic advantages. And those were the ones ultimately who are rewarded, which feels like a pretty good place to end this podcast. Marshall, thank you so much for coming on. This was so much fun. I feel like I learned a lot. Remind people to go follow you. It's M Newhouse 73.
Yes, at M Newhouse 73 on Twitter, Instagram. And I send some tweets while I'm watching the game, and eventually it'll be producing a little content, trying to get myself involved, but I appreciate you. It's been an absolute pleasure.
This is fun talking ball. You can watch this on YouTube as well, youtube.com/@MinaKimes. And as a reminder, podcast listeners who are in Vegas, who are going to Vegas or going to the Super Bowl, the link for the live show, which I'm only sending out, we'll put in the link in the notes for this podcast. It's bit.ly/MinaFox, I think. Yeah.
There will be hats.
Sorry, MinaFox is right. MinaFox. I like that. All right. Well, this was amazing. And I will be back later this week with my friend Shiel Kapadia previewing a very exciting divisional round.